there was already an attempt in the early 90s following the Iraq war to set up a mechanism at the UN, which is called the UN Register on Conventional Weapons, which is a kind of weak mechanism where states can report on exports and imports of conventional weapons. It's based on a voluntary basis, it's not a legally binding instrument. With regards to human security more broadly, we can divide it in two: socioeconomic development on the one hand and human rights on the other. I think we all know the effect that armed violence has on a society, on certain country. And as we all know, since the 90s, the conflict became more internalized, and the role of small arms and light weapons is obvious to all in the effect it has on civilian casualty. But not only in terms of physical violence, but also the socio-economic aspect of it. The diversion of resources in acquiring arms for a country, the impact it has on the society. So at the global level, there's been a different attempt to control this phenomenon. I can cite the UN Program of Action on Small Arms, the UN Firearms Protocol, the International Tracing Instrument, and also the Geneva Declaration on Armed Violence and Development. On the other hand, when we talk about arms trade, we must be aware that obviously there is the aspect of equality, of sovereignty among states, the right to self-defense. There are rationales related to economics, to prestige, to national security. So we have competing interests that are embodied in this wound process. Briefly, three main challenges: the scope of the conflict. So what type of weapons would be included? Reference is made to the UN Register on Conventional Arms. Seven types of weapons: battle tanks, large caliber artillery system, combat aircraft, attack helicopters. Seven categories. Now, the idea was also to include another category, the small arms and light weapons. As we know, they are as deadly, if not more, than conventional arms. And also one of the challenges was to include another category, 7+1+1, which would be ammunition and munition. The second challenge is the parameter, the criteria governing arms transfer. So what are the rules that states should apply when deciding whether or not to authorize an arms transfer to another country? Do we refer to shall consider, shall not authorize a transfer of arms if there is a substantial risk, a clear risk, an overriding risk that the weapons will be used to commit serious violation of human rights law and IHME international humanitarian law? What are the criteria? Professor Clapham will dwell onto the issue. And the third main challenge is what would be the reporting and implementation mechanism of such a treaty to monitor the compliance of future state parties? Are we referring to a mandatory reporting system? What about victim assistance that have been put forward by certain states like Norway? And to conclude, besides the substantive challenge, there has been another main challenge in this negotiation, which is of a procedural nature. As you probably know, they decided to adopt the rule of consensus for agreement on substantive issues during the negotiation. This was mainly because of the United States, to engage the United States, who decided to put forward this idea, which was actually taken up. And the negotiation were somehow driven by this procedural limitation, because as you know, usually in treaty making, the treaties are adopted at two-thirds majority. The fact of putting forward the consensus rule has
Obviously, the risk to spoil the whole process, because a few states can block the process. So that was another challenge that we have faced. Two-broad approach. On the one hand, we have states that tend to prefer to have a very minimalistic arms trade treaty that would focus only on illicit trade, concerning a limited number of weapons, and on the other hand, the other states that are instead of a more robust treaty, as they like to put it, which would govern all international transfer of conventional arms to ensure that they are responsible. So here is the constant tension that we noticed, we observed during the negotiation. Now I give the talk to Professor Jackson.
Thank you very much, Neil. He was too modest maybe to mention the arms trade treaty little blog. So for those of you who are interested, we will continue to do that during the next phase of negotiations. So there's a daily entry which explains what's going on with the treaty negotiations. So you've heard some of the challenges. I'm now going to go into some of the details. I mean, the point of the treaty, at least from my perspective and from people who work on human rights, is that you should be able to prevent arms from fueling human rights violations or violations of international humanitarian law. What's at stake here, I think, is that the treaty has a number of flaws or loopholes in it, and if it were to be adopted in its current form, arguably it could be worse than no treaty. Now, why do I say that? Well, I think it's worse than no treaty because a weak treaty would enable states to say, we are abiding by international law. We are in conformity with the Arms Trade Treaty. And that Arms Trade Treaty allows for states to avoid their international obligations, and so arguably it's worse than the current situation where we have existing international law, which would arguably prevent a transfer where those weapons would be used or would facilitate war crimes and crimes against humanity. And secondly, and I think this is maybe a bit legalistic for some of you, but I think there's a real problem that national legislators would say, let us change our national law so that it's in conformity with the new Arms Trade Treaty. That is the new international standard. And there you can have a situation where existing law, for example in Switzerland, is quite good, and they say, well, let's bring it into line with the international standard, and you go to the lowest common denominator situation. And you can see the economics of this. There will be arguments by the arms manufacturers. We have to have a level playing field. We have to use the international standards. And as you will see, the current draft has some problems. So very briefly, and the first problem I would mention here would be what I would call a complicity problem. That's to say, the standard that is used to judge what the intention of the supplying state is. The second problem, which I'll come to in a minute, is the definition of war crime. And the third problem has been alluded to, is the balancing problem. So let me go into a bit more detail. So it's an arms trade treaty. As you've heard, it covers the seven categories of arms, conventional weapons that you can read about in the draft there. But it doesn't cover what are called weapons of mass destruction, the ABC weapons, atomic weapons, biological weapons, or chemical weapons. But there are a couple of other types of material that are not covered, and if you think about it, they're quite important in the current context. So, for example, crowd control material such as tear gas would not be covered. It's not considered a conventional weapon, nor would rubber bullets, if I've understood the interpretation of the treaty correctly. So if you think about the current climate and our wish to prevent human rights violations, you might want in fact to say, well, we're more concerned about tear gas and rubber bullets than we are about battleships. So I leave that as a thought. It's an arms trade treaty, but arms is limited to some extent. There are also problems with the definition of ammunition. It's not quite clear if it covers munitions. Munitions would include landmines and grenades. Again, clearly incredibly relevant in the current context. It's a trade treaty. Now, here there's some ambiguity in the drafting. Would it cover a gift or a loan? Arguably, if you give somebody arms, you're not trading in arms, and therefore you wouldn't get covered. A lot of the definitions in the treaty you'll see are sort of a little all over the place. Our interpretation is that because the treaty is basically about exporting arms, and exports would include both loans and gifts, those could be caught, but obviously in an ideal world that would be tightened up. Now let me now turn to the three sort of points that I was alluding to earlier.
The first point is in Article 3, which covers the what I'm calling the prohibitions. So I'll just, I hope you can see it here. Article 3. Para 3. If you can read that or you can find it in there. In the briefing, it says the state party shall not authorize a transfer within the scope of this treaty for the purpose of facilitating the commission of genocide crimes against humanity or war crimes. Well, for the purpose of is too high a text, in my humble opinion. If you are prosecuting somebody for supplying a gun, a man who sells a gun in a shop, you don't have to show that the supplier has the same purpose as the person who is selling, who is buying the gun. It's enough that you have knowledge. To prove that a state had the purpose of committing genocide by supplying arms to the genocidaire in the other country is clearly never going to work. States will never reveal that their purpose in supplying arms was to commit war crimes, crimes against humanity, or genocide. So that test is, I would say, higher than the existing international law test. The existing international law test, we know from the International Court of Justice in the Bosnia and Serbia genocide case. So there, the International Court, and I'll just give you this one brief quote, said, there cannot be a finding of complicity against the state unless, at the least, its organs were aware that genocide was about to be committed. Well, being aware that your arms are going to be used for genocide and having a purpose that they're going to be used for genocide are two different international intention tests. And then the International Court goes on, and if the aid or assistance supplied from the moment they became so aware onwards to the perpetrators of the criminal acts or those who were at the point of committing them enabled or facilitated the commission of the acts, in other words, an accomplice must have given support in perpetrating the genocide with full knowledge of the facts. So it's either an awareness test or a knowledge test, but it's not a purpose test. And even in the area of individual criminal responsibility, if you consider the recent conviction of Charles Taylor for supplying weapons with regards to the war crimes committed in Sierra Leone, the court that convicted him said, although the lending of practical assistance, encouragement or moral support must itself be intentional, the intent to commit the crime or underlying offence is not required. In other words, Charles Taylor only had to intend to supply the weapons. He didn't have to intend for the crime to be committed. And the Swiss government and others have suggested that this purpose language here in Article 3 could be adjusted to come more into line with what one would expect of international law in this area. The second problem with this paragraph is, I think, the definition of war crimes here. I'm using the I word here because I don't want to mislead anybody that this is necessarily the position of All Arms Survey or the Swiss government or any of the other people who have commented on the report. So it's not that it's all about me, it's Stuart and Sarah's report, but we're just trying to be especially careful as to not to implicate those who are mentioned as commenting. So the problem here is that it says the purpose of facilitating the commission of genocide, crimes against humanity or war crimes constituting grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions or violations of Common Article 3. That sounds great. It sounds as though it covers the most serious war crimes. But in fact, it doesn't. The shelling of a civilian population, or a disproportionate attack resulting in excessive civilian loss, or even sniping at civilians, are not covered by those clauses. In fact, most of the war crimes currently being committed in Syria would not be covered. So the exact problem that the treaty is designed to address is not actually covered by this prohibition in Article 3.3. Again, Switzerland and others have suggested that the war crimes expression there be adjusted, and you can see the wording in the commentary that we've provided, so that it would cover disproportionate attacks on civilians and others. Now, the next important article that I quickly refer you to is Article 4, which on first sight looks quite good, because you can see here that you're not allowed to authorize an export if it's going to be used to commit or facilitate serious violations of humanitarian law or human rights. So probably my concerns about this technical issue about war crimes are covered. But there's a problem here, at least according to some commentators. Not everybody agrees. But if you have to look carefully at little paragraph 5 here, what it says is that if after you've looked at paragraphs 1 and 2, and then you consider the human rights situation or the humanitarian law situation is overriding, you may not authorise the export. The problem is that what's been snuck into paragraph 1, which you have to take into account, is this rather unfortunate and vague phrase, whether the arms are going to undermine peace and security. In other words, on one reading, you weigh peace and security on the one hand and human rights violations on the other hand, and if your overriding sense is that human rights are going to be violated and that overrides your peace and security concerns, you don't authorise. The problem with that is that it leaves open the option to say, I think peace and security here is more important than the human rights violations. Those are the overriding concerns. Now, I'm not sure that that's necessarily the only reading of this provision, but it's certainly the reading of many delegations who don't like this one word, overriding. It came into the negotiations at the 11th hour. It was never really properly discussed. The original expression was substantial risk, which, to be frank, is a much better formulation. If there is a substantial risk of war crimes or human rights, you don't authorise. End of story. Now we have this apparent balancing exercise. Is it overriding? Overriding what? Overriding peace and security concerns. Now, in the paper, we have suggested that the word overriding be replaced by the expression substantial risk, or possibly clear risk, which is the EU conduct common position position, and which can be found in other texts as well. Another expression might be overwhelming, which would suggest that you are weighing the risk rather than balancing the risk. I think if the overriding expression goes through with the interpretation that it really is something to be balanced against your security concerns, it's actually a step backwards, because it takes away the idea that human rights are something absolute that can be never violated under any circumstances. It suggests there's one policy issue to be thrown into the mix. A further flaw, which has concerned many civil society organisations, is this one, Article 5.2, the top paragraph on the overhead here. It says the implementation of this treaty shall not prejudice obligations undertaken with regards to other instruments. That rather suggests that if you've got a treaty to supply arms that's already existing, this treaty, which says you shouldn't supply arms, shouldn't take effect, and certainly doesn't affect your other obligations. Now, Switzerland and others have suggested that that be deleted. There's been some buy-in to that from the Indian delegation. I think for many, this is the most problematic provision. As I say, I think it may not survive, and I'm not sure that it was really intended necessarily to do what it seems to say it does. A couple of final details, because I'd like to allow the time for question. The treaty will enter into force after 65 ratifications. Now, that's relatively high for a multilateral treaty. It could mean that the treaty, even if we get a good text and it's fairly popular, would not enter into force for many, many years to come. Interestingly, there is a provision which mitigates this, which says that states can provisionally apply Articles 3 and 4. Those are the ones which prohibit the transfer that I was talking about earlier, by making a simple declaration. So Switzerland or Russia or the United States, on adhering to the treaty, can declare that it will accept the provisions of 3 and 4, which are the non-authorization provisions, even if the other 62 countries in the world have not ratified it. And that provision has been used to some effect with the Landmines and Cluster Munitions Convention. And lastly, in order to finish on time, I will mention the implementation provision, which Gilles Jatta alluded to, but there is one provision which I found particularly weak, which is that there's no provision for referral of a dispute to the International Court of Justice. Now, in a multilateral treaty these days, that would be fairly common. All it says is that by mutual consent, states can refer their dispute to negotiation, mediation, conciliation, or arbitration. In the paper, we have suggested that it would be better to include a clause which says, in the event of a dispute, states' parties can go to the International Court of Justice. So, to conclude, I think there is quite a lot of at stake in the final round of negotiations. I think it's a shame if we miss this opportunity to get a good arms trade treaty. If we don't get a good one, the chance won't come around again in our lifetime, I would suggest. even the amendment provisions for the Arms Trade Treaty are very tightly drawn at the moment. You can only amend this treaty by consensus, which means that it's unlikely that serious problems that can't get ironed out now will get ironed out in the future. So I think it's going to be too late for the victims in Syria. I think there's absolutely no reason not to try and prevent the next round of atrocities through an effective armed approach. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank
you. Should I moderate the discussion? Because I can see you better. Yeah, who would like to ask the first question? Yes, sir.
Robert James Carson, journalist from the Aviation Ed. I'd like to know which delegation introduced at the 11th hour the balance between peace and security and human rights.
I think it's widely known, and I'm not giving away any secrets because I wasn't privy to any confidential discussions, that this is a US-led idea, but obviously with some support. I think many states are against it, but as it came at the 11th hour, there wasn't time to debate it properly. It was also clear that there are no questions. Yeah, at the back, yes.
Hello, I'm Maria Munoz from Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. I must say that I'm not the disarmament expert in my organization. We have a disarmament program which is very much involved in this process and not a lot more than I do. But from my point of view, what I am interested in knowing is what do you think would be the impact for women of this treaty, taking into account that the small arms trade and the small arms flow inside countries has a great impact on domestic violence in the house. So how do you think these treaties can be, as it is right now, influential and good to prevent that flow inside the country? Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, this is obviously an important point. Within Article 4, I'll try and find it for you quickly in here. Paragraph 6. Some of the factors that states have to take into consideration when working out whether they are allowed to authorize or not include 6b, whether the weapons would be used to commit or facilitate gender-based violence or violence against children. So that is something that has been factored in. It's been quite an important point during the negotiations. And I think a number of delegations are committed to ensuring that this obviously remains in the treaty as a factor, which in turn will generate reports on the extent to which weapons are being used in this way. But it will also then feed on into some of the more complex provisions at the end in terms of cooperation and information sharing and so on. So it's certainly relevant. Did you want to add something?
Yeah, Just to touch on what Andrew said, he's right. There is an express reference to gender-based violence in the treaty, and that was very much considered a success and a coup for those working on gender issues. But I would say it's an unfortunate placement where it's ended up, because 6B, of course, only asks states to consider taking feasible measures to consider these issues in the context of arms transfer. In a sense, it would be better to leave it out altogether and let it be inferred in Article 4.2 as in the context of international human rights violations without an express reference. In the end, that's what I think that would have had a better outcome for gender interests. But maybe in the next round of negotiations in March next year, we will see a change of placement or a change in that provision. But currently, I think it's good to keep it.
Thank you very much, Sarah. Yes, that point is detailed in more detail in the briefing you have. Yes. Sorry, behind you, and then you.
Thank you. Mohsenai from MIA. I would like to know the role and place of non-state actors in this treaty. Is there any assumption about the private military industries and the
yes, well, that's a big question. Of course, as you mentioned, it's the private military companies themselves. So a transfer to a state where those companies were working, where it was likely, or whether there was an overriding risk or an overwhelming risk that they would be used to commit either human rights violations or violations of the laws of war, would be prohibited. That would be covered. What's a little more complicated, and which is not dealt with explicitly in the treaty, is whether or not you could transfer arms to a rebel group. And just to sort of make the point dramatically, it's not clear whether arms to be supplied to the Free Syrian Army would be covered or prohibited under this treaty. To the extent that they are not committing human rights violations or violations of the laws of war. Several states would like to have a blanket prohibition which says under no circumstances may arms be transferred to an unsafe actor. That, on, at least on our reading, is not actually included in the treaty at the moment. It would only be a violation to transfer them where that group was committing the sorts of war crimes that I referred to earlier. So that indeed is a big question mark. And I think several states, and I think, again, I know it's a big secret, including the United States, would like to leave their options open to be able to transfer to rebel groups. Several other states would like a situation where it would always be forbidden to transfer arms to non-state actors. It's already forbidden under Security Council resolution to transfer weapons of mass destruction to a non-state actor. But otherwise, it's complicated. It would be governed by general international law, and I think after the Nicaragua-United States case, it's pretty clear that it's most likely to be an intervention in internal affairs to transfer arms to a non-state actor. But under the treaty, it's a bit left unsaid. Yes. So the question was, what happens if there's a conflict between international law and this treaty? Again, that's quite a difficult question to answer. My fear, the existing international law ought to continue to apply. What I was trying to suggest is that in reality what will happen is that this then becomes the standard, so that people will refer to this as the new international standard on arms transfers, and any existing international law sort of wouldn't necessarily be altered by this, but might be overlooked. It certainly wouldn't be the focus of a national parliament that was keen to bring itself into line with the treaty law as opposed to international law. By international law in this context, I mean customary international law. Yes.
Hi, I'm Jeff Moran, I'm a senior executive program. I had a question about looking into the future and understanding that the situation is quite uncertain, but there's been some thought that with Mexico having such a prominent, outspoken position about its problems with what's already been settled, or at least documented, there is a possibility that this might go outside the UN eventually, perhaps under the leadership of a Mexican delegation. I mean, how do you see the future in terms of the possibility or the probability of this sort of eventuality?
That's a very good question. I think at this point one has to put on one's hat as a sort of amateur psychologist. I think many people are sort of quite tired of this process. As you explained, we've had four preparatory meetings, there's been expert working groups, there's a long negotiation in New York. If people feel at the next meeting in New York that they're nearly there and better to have this treaty and get it done with now than to start another new process that's uncertain, even if the treaty is not great, fatigue might set in, even amongst the civil society groups, and they say, let's just get this done. A lot of people have been following this for many years now. They'd probably like to see it finished on their watch. However, I think there's a good chance that if people realize that they're going to get something which is worse than nothing, or it's a missed opportunity, and if the Mexican leadership, as you say, really has the stomach for this, it could get taken outside the UN, and one could move to a different type of negotiation where the text could be adopted, as Gilles Jacques said, under the normal rule of two-thirds majority, and arguably we'd get a much better text. And those states that are currently being difficult and blocking consensus would not be amongst those two-thirds, but many would say that doesn't matter because they wouldn't have joined the treaty anyway. Better to have a good treaty amongst a few states, as with landmines, than to get bogged down in a UN consensus process. So I think it depends a bit on the stomach of the diplomats, if I can put it like that. I don't know, Sarah, you're very close to this, maybe you've got the thought.
I think, well, at the moment, just to give an update on what the process is doing, I'm sure you already know this, but at the moment there is a resolution before the first meeting of the Secretary General Assembly in New York that is proposing to extend the conference for another 2 weeks in March next year. So the current proposal is there's two more weeks of negotiations with the text that was agreed or presented, sorry, on the 26th of July as a basis for that further negotiation. So there's still potential for this to be achieved and agreed within the UN system. Obviously that there will be more amendments and more problem over changes. If that doesn't succeed, if there is no agreement, then there are two options, as you've discussed and as Andrew mentioned. You can be taken out of the process, or whatever state the draft treaty is in at the end of the March meeting could be adopted at the General Assembly as an annex to a resolution. That's another option. But taking out of the UN process, I mean, there's pros and cons. I think Andrew already given an illustration of the benefits. It could be you have a stronger treaty and you have those states that want a robust, worthwhile treaty will sign up to it, ratify it, and so on and so forth. I mean, personally, I'd like to see the UN disarmament process achieve something in multilateral disarmament, and I think the APT, even if it's not as strong as it could be, I would prefer to see it stay in the UN system. Whether that's going to happen remains to be seen, but I think it's, I know people sort of talk about the success of landmines and the success of cluster munitions, which are adopted and agreed outside the UN process, but in terms of their norm-creating ability, it remains to be seen. And I think the ATT, which is a much more complex beast, requires and needs global commitment and universal adherence and commitment. So if we can get as many states on board by keeping it within the UN system, that's my preferred option.
Cheers, yeah.
Yeah, to draw a parallel with the cluster convention munition, it's true that we end up having a really strong treaty outside the UN. But I think I would like to emphasize the point that that is now the international standard at the end of the day. So one should not maybe overestimate that. We have a strong treaty, of course, there are many states that are not party to, including Syria, for example, but when we hear about Syria using cluster munitions, you know, it comes like as natural to say they are violating international standards. So I think here, I would say, you know, there, as I said, there's pros and cons to go outside the UN, but I think that it's not because we go outside the UN and we have a more robust treaty that it doesn't become in the years to come the standard.
Yes.
Lisa Scurro, MIL student at the Institute. I know that the EF treaty is built in the framework of international state responsibilities. However, behind this input and export, there are people who are doing this. So what could be the impact of this treaty within the framework of international criminal law and international criminal responsibility of those who are involved in this trademark?
Thank you. That's an excellent question. And we have suggested in the briefing there that although the treaty itself doesn't contain international crimes which could be applied to individuals, there's no reason why the national legislation in implementing the treaty shouldn't create criminal offences within the national jurisdiction, and that indeed would be the preferred option. So as with landmines, where it's a crime to supply landmines in violation of the treaty, one could do the same thing here, so that one would catch the individuals, and I might add also one could include corporate criminal responsibility in the national legal order there in implementing legislation. So it is foreseen, even if this is not, strictly speaking, an international criminal law treaty. Professor Keith Crowe.
Yeah, I have a comment with a question, and it concerns the issue of national assessment, which you spent a bit of time on. It's unlike the Landmines and Cluster Munitions Treaty, which are essentially bans that require very little interpretation on the part of the state about the validity or legitimacy of its actions. This one is all about the politics, not just about the law. And I know that previous experiences with attempts to impose relatively robust national controls, going back to President Carter in the 1970s, but certainly also the quote-unquote more human rights-oriented policy under Tony Blair and other EU states, these all ran into great difficulties of interpretation, even when there was a political will on the part of a state to exercise or impose strong criteria. So I'm having some difficulty seeing how this is going to make a difference. And I'm being deliberately provocative here, because I do think it will make a difference, but I think that you know, a strong treaty negotiated outside the UN system has a much better chance of limiting the scope for malicious interpretation, shall we say, than a treaty within the system where states will insert the caveats that they will insert. So I guess I wonder how you think this particular issue of national assessment will play itself out, or where you would put your weight on the next few months of negotiation. Because I think it's, there's a significant risk that we end up with a pretty instrument that actually doesn't change anything that actually happens in the world. And that, I think, would be tragic.
Well, thank you. Yes. Before I pass the floor to Sarah. I think it all turns on the difference between Article 3 and Article 4. So in Article 3, little 3, which you can see at the top here, there's no national assessment. It just says a state shall not authorize a transfer where, and then we've got these two problems, where they have the purpose of facilitating. So if we can get rid of purpose and say where they are aware or have knowledge of, then that's okay. Genocide and crimes against humanity are obviously fine and clear terms. But then we have this, what looks like a great expression and looks terribly sort of Geneva and perfect. War crimes constituting great breaches of the Geneva Conventions and Common Article 3. But as I've suggested to you, that's got a flaw in it or a loophole. And I don't, unfortunately, it's not even something you can really fight with people on, because it's such a technical point, and I don't even think it's deliberate that somebody said, look, we're going to exclude shelling of civilians because that's what we really want our arms to be used for. I think they just don't necessarily, I mean, the ICRC have obviously explained it 100 times, but I don't think people have really understood that grave breaches means you've got to be in international armed conflict. So the conflict in Syria is not even caught by the first part. And then Common Article 3 basically refers to people who you have within your hands, in other words, your detainees. So if you use the guns to sort of kill your prisoners, obviously that's covered. But Common Article 3 doesn't cover a disproportionate killing of civilians in the downtown Damascus. It's just not part of Common Article 3, according to the conventional reading of it. So if this could be changed, I think the treaty could do a lot. Now, you're absolutely right. If you then have to go to Article 4 to get the prohibition, the national assessment, as it's currently being designed, is not a national assessment as to whether there's a serious risk of human rights violations, which I think arguably could be good, but a national assessment first looking at questions of peace and security, not even international peace and security, but peace and security, which is a sort of a strange expression. So in the security interests of my state, that state get these weapons. And that's one of the considerations that I'm going to take into account in my national assessment. And who can second judge my national assessment, as you're suggesting? It's nowhere written that we could all go to the International Court of Justice and say, your national assessment is unreasonable. So I rather agree with you. I think the national assessment provisions, as they're written, if they're really intended to do what some people think they're intended to do with overriding, are problematic. If we could fix Article 3, I think it would be less problematic. Because Article 3 doesn't ask for a national assessment, it just says you shall not authorize if you have prospects of crimes against humanity, genocide, or some war crimes. But did you want to add something, Sarah, on national assessment?
Do I have any choice?
Yeah.
excellent question, Dr. Gareth. I would say this. I mean, I am disappointed in a number of things in this treaty, and one of them was I was expecting and hoping that there would be, in the implementation mechanism, some kind of review system. obviously the state's not going to make a decision to license what otherwise exports by consensus within a system like this, but I hope that there will be some ability to request clarification on a decision that a state has made, so there'd be some kind of holding to account. Now, it doesn't appear in the implementation section. There were some calls for it early on, but obviously it hasn't carried favour with all the states in question. But what I would say is I still think that can evolve within the treaty system. There's nothing that says at a later date, even though we have this issue with amendment requiring consensus, there's nothing to say that if states get more comfortable with the idea of an arms trade treaty that limits or certainly makes it more difficult for them to export conventional weapons, and as our political climate changes and so on, that raise your eyebrows, that a review mechanism or something like a review mechanism couldn't be established when we're in a better place. But otherwise, I agree with you. I think the national assessment system, as it currently stands and as it's drafted, doesn't change much at all and won't make much of a difference. But I think once the treaty's up and running, and that's when its norm-creating abilities kick in, that can change over time. Right now, states are still very uncomfortable with the idea of an arms trade treaty, including some of the major exporters and those states that we want to get on board. This is the first step, I would say, in this kind of process, and we won't achieve everything that close. So,
and just in that upbeat note, there's another way, of course, that you could control the national assessment, which is through the national legislation. So a country, as you say, like the United Kingdom, will have to have national legislation which says that arms cannot be transferred where there is a risk that they will be used to commit human rights violations. And if there is a prospect that those arms are going to be transferred, there would be, you know, what would be called a judicial review of that governmental action. And the plaintiffs would be arguing that in conducting this assessment, they didn't take into account the 5 reports from Amnesty International and the 4 reports from Human Rights Watch and so on and so forth. And therefore, it's not a good faith decision. And the judge would say, I'm overriding the minister's decision in this, we're putting an injunction on these arms leaving because that would be a violation not only of our international obligations, but of national law and so on. So it says national assessment, but under the normal route of things, you would be able to review it at the national level for legality, even if you couldn't review the policy implications. Yes.
Well, I don't think I need a microphone.
Yeah, it's done.
My name is Joshua Neal from the Geneva Academy. I have a question about the language of the provisions, especially where it attributes responsibility on the state. A lot of it seems to focus on the fact that a state party should have authorized a transfer or authorized any kind of trade in particular arms. I'm more concerned about the interpretation of authorized. I think that some states would evade responsibility if they could say there is no explicit or proper express form of authorization on their part. Because many times if there's any kind of trade in arms, states are very good at hiding behind, you know, and they're not usually provide an express kind of authorization for arms trade, because that's a bit too obvious. So is there any way in which the language can deal with any other form, probably a facilitation of trade, probably any other form of implied authority that could be given by a state to trade in arms?
Well, I think you make a good point, and at some point in the negotiations, some of us suggested that rather than authorising, we should be talking about permitting, because if you know that an arms deal is going down and you know about it but you haven't authorised it, maybe you should be obliged to stop it. But states are, I think, not ready to go down that route in terms of this treaty. They want to talk about the so-called licit trade, or the trade which is authorised. So it's deliberate that they've used the language of authorization, and you're absolutely right, it might not necessarily cover transfers where the state was not involved. But for the most part, that what states are trying to control here is state authorizations. I don't know if you wanted to add anything.
No, that's right. I think, again, the political climate is such that the treaty can only address, and I think probably appropriately so, legitimate authorized transfers, and states do, most states that export weapons do have an export control system in place that involves licensing and authorization. So I think in the context it is appropriate.
Yes, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much. My name is Peter Berry, and I'm working on development issues. I have a general comment and some questions. First, a general comment is about the legality and legitimacy of a flag. So, do you think that we reached a certain point that the arms trade would be legitimate? Or we try to somehow move toward distinguishing between the illegal arms trade and legal arms trade, or we already have something in that regard or not. I think having reviewed the different policies and different position of the state and different legal system, contradicting the legal system in major countries which export this conventional weapon or produce this conventional weapon, I think there's a little tendency toward moving toward the legality or legitimacy of this term, and this is the main problem. So this is the general comment, and then the question is, how can we expand the scope of this treaty? Because if we as you rightly mentioned, we have a weak instrument that would be not conducive to our goals. So the other question is, what would be the role of third party? Because you are talking about bilateral. For example, in Switzerland, sell something to a third to country X, and then it doesn't have any control. What would be the next step after the delivery of the weapon to the country X? As we see some of the weapons produced by Switzerland in conflict in Syria. While the original purpose of Switzerland was not to deliver that to that issue. And then the issue of verification. How can again we work some sort of verification in which or monitoring system which provide assurances to state that we can monitor the flow of this arms trade. Thank you.
Thank you. Would you like to comment in a moment?
Yes,
sure. So before passing it to Sarah, I would make a couple of points. Firstly, with regards to legitimation, it's true, of course, and one of the criticisms that could be levelled at this whole exercise is that this is tending to legitimate the arms trade treaty. My sort of reaction to that, and I think probably other people's reaction might be, well, we have the same problem with all laws of war, that by writing the Geneva Conventions or developing protocols to the Geneva Conventions, you seem to be legitimating recourse to force and armed conflict. But this is an attempt not really to legitimate the Arms Trade Treaty, but to prevent arms from being used where they will violate human rights or IHL. And I think it's probably worth the risk that you may be lending some legitimacy, but on the other hand, you're going to gain some transparency. With regards to the third-party question, I mean, it doesn't actually say that if you look at what I've put back here under 4.2, prior to authorization and pursuant to its national control system, the state party should assess whether the proposed export could be used to commit a serious violation of IHL. It doesn't say it could be used by the other state party or the other state to do that. All you've got to do, or rather what you've got to do, is to find out how it might be used. So if it's likely that it's going to be passed on to somebody else who's going to commit that violation, that, I would argue, would have to come into your national assessment. Now, there are some quite complicated points about end users and end user certificates, which I'm going to pass to the more technical expert.
Just to pick up on the point about third party and how you can control the delivery of the weapons once they arrive in the recipient importing country, how does the original exporter then prevent them being re-imported. Well, I mean, the idea is that if all states are party to this, then of course they are bound to apply their national assessments to any re-export of those weapons. So I would argue that when you're making a decision as a state party to this treaty, whether or not to export an item to another country, one of the considerations you might consider is whether or not that importing country, that recipient, is in fact a state party to the Arms Trade Treaty and will in turn be applying the criteria of the Arms Trade Treaty to its to a national assessment of a re-export of those weapons. I hope that's clear. There was some discussion, and certainly states raised the possibility of including end-use requirements for end-use verification or end-use controls. And I know there is a phrase somewhere in here where it's referenced, and I can't remember it offhand. But there is no delivery verification requirement. It has come under discussion. Perhaps it will come under discussion in March. And I'm sorry, I will find the phrase and get back to you separately. In terms of verification and monitoring, well, I think we touched on that with Dr. Krauss's question about there's no mechanism to review the decisions that states make. That said, I think that the Arms Trade Treaty does open itself up to further information exchange between state parties and discussions on the viability of recipients. The other thing is, I think what will inevitably happen is the ATT, the Arms Trade Treaty, will create a framework for civil society and NGOs to start doing more monitoring of arms transfers, which is what happens with landmines and custom munitions. NGOs have set up monitoring mechanisms where treaties themselves may not have as good a mechanism as you might choose. In terms of the comment you made about legality and legitimacy, and I think Andrew's addressed this, but when you were mentioning it, the thing that came into my head is when we talk about the Arms Trade Treaty creating a new tier of illegal transfers. It's not quite true. It's trying to inject this concept of irresponsible transfers. Illegal transfers are those that are prohibited by embargoes and so on and so forth. The ATT is introducing a new tier, which is where arms transfers are considered irresponsible and therefore illegal, which is, it already happens under BASMA and the EU Common Position, and in a sense, the Arms Trade Treaty is just universalising that concept. But it is quite complex because it's not a ban. It's an obligation to apply an assessment, but you might get different results among different states. So that was the thing I was making that.
Thank you, Patrick. I'm under very strict instructions to finish on time, so I think that's actually a very good point to end on. And maybe just to clarify, you said, you know, this seems to be about bilateral relations. One thing to be very clear about is it doesn't matter if the receiving state is not a party to the treaty. So if Syria, to give the obvious example, is not a party to this treaty, but Switzerland or Russia or somebody else is, the treaty comes into effect. The obligations are on the state party, which is the exporting state. It doesn't matter who you're exporting to. So there's a potential for quite wide impact as long as a few exporting states decide to either adhere to the treaty and say it comes into immediate effect or wait till the 65 finally ratified. So I hope you've enjoyed this, and I'm going to close the meeting now. Thank you.